Boy, did it ever feel good to be together in person last week? And I say that with some caution, perhaps, in my spirit, because there were lots of us that weren't able to be there, or that for a variety of reasons chose not to be there. And I don't want to create two groups of people in the community by saying that that felt good. I also don't want to acknowledge that it really did. And it was lovely, even with all the restrictions that impacted that experience. It was really quite moving. It's interesting to me how we can experience sadness and joy at the same time. In that instance of being together in person, the mix was the joy of seeing others face to face and the sadness at the limitations of expressing that joy, of not being able to hug people that we would know are comfortable with being exchanging hugs, or to shake hands, or to even just sort of stand deeply in someone's space with a sense of their permission to be there and speak close to one another about things that are also close to our hearts or deep in our lives. Like it was a mix for sure. I do want to thank people for showing up online as well. I've spoken with some of you, and I know that as we suspected, it was a bit hard to hear. People were sharing different things as well, and that's just hard to pick up when you're broadcasting, with a phone. That's part of just keeping it simple and keeping it inexpensive, so as well. And so that we knew that that might be a challenge. In any case, we're back to this format today, and although we can't kind of be together and see one another, you'll be able to hear me. I'm not sure that's a net gain, honestly. I think I'd trade one of those for the other in a minute. But in any case, I'm grateful for this way of being together. I'm also grateful for the earth. And that might sound like a obvious thing to say, but I think it's important to stop and acknowledge it and to name it. I'm grateful not just for the earth generic, but I'm grateful for this part of it, for this continent, for this province. And I say that as a way of representing geography this morning, rather than a way of representing governance in particular. I am grateful as a person with European settler heritage to continue to be welcomed on this piece of land by the First Nations, by the Indigenous peoples, who were here long before anyone with my heritage showed up. It's a gift. It was a gift then, and it's a gift now. And I'm grateful. I realize that in our context at the table, it's always a little bit of a hazardous thing to recommend a book. I'm going to do it anyway. I'm just going to take the book by its covers and do it anyway. One of the things that I feel like I'm continually doing is unraveling the myths or the guiding stories that I've been handed. And some of those myths are about the history of Canada. And some of them I learned in school. They were the stories of the day, in the dominant system of the day. And some of them I learned from the culture around me. A book that I'm presently finding very helpful in the process of reconsidering those stories is a book called Indigenous Rights. And it is Rights is spelled WRITES, Indigenous WRITES. The author is Chelsea Vowell. Chelsea Vowell is a Métis lawyer, intellectual, writer, educator. And the book is really engaging. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. It's interesting. It is zesty. She's got lots of personality, and it shows up in her writing in delightful ways. It's also her lawyerliness shows up in her writing in the sense that the book is thoroughly annotated. And so I think sometimes when we're reading about things that challenge us, or that challenge stories that are deeply embedded in us, it's easy to kind of go to the, oh, that's that person's opinion, or who can you believe, what can you trust? And those are good questions, and those are important feelings. And so a deeply annotated work can also be helpful, because if you encounter one of those ideas, or you just bump into an idea that you want to chase down for whatever reason, the information you need to do so for yourself is there. And that can be really impacting as well. I haven't had a lot of time to chase down annotations from that book, but the ones that I have followed through have taken me to consistently interesting, engaging, and challenging places. So if you want to unravel some of the myth of what it means to be a part of this country, then I would encourage you to get Indigenous Rights from the library and give it a read. I think one of the other reasons this book is resonating for me is because it dovetails so well with my ongoing experience of realizing the power and the importance of stories in general, as well as the disconcerting experience of realizing that some stories that I've been basing my life around are not complete, or maybe not even a good match for the discernible facts. And that's an interesting experience. And it's also been reminding me of both the hard work and the joy of digging in and making those stories bigger and more complete. Now, when we make our stories bigger and more complete, one of the things that quite naturally happens is we also make them more complex. And that means that I don't get to just sort of hang out in my corner of the universe with my kind of people and our preferred versions of stories anymore. And that means that I'm almost constantly encountering other ways of looking at the world that challenge the ways of looking at the world that I had before, that challenge the stories that I already felt like I knew. And that includes my religious stories. A friend of mine recently shared their experience of listening to a podcast on which the physicist Sean Carroll was a guest. And Carroll is a quantum physicist, and in this podcast, he was talking about quantum physics. And my friend, as they were listening to this podcast, said, when they posted about it, they said they felt like they were listening to someone offer the best accidental description of religion that they had ever heard. The best accidental description of religion. And I think what they meant by that was they were listening to someone offer a description of their experience with quantum physics that felt like it really was or could be understood as a description of religion. So I'm going to read you a quote from that podcast, and I want you to remember as you listen to this, this is Sean Carroll, a physicist, and he's talking about physics when he says these things. Do you really believe this? Are you really taking this seriously? And look, that's a perfectly good question. It's a very respectable question. This idea is not crazy or weird or bizarre, but it's certainly very, very far away from our everyday experience. What it's asking you to do is say, I have these questions. They are really, really good at fitting what I do observe in the world and making predictions. I will take them seriously, even for things I can't directly observe. Because they're the best equations I have. Until a better set of equations comes along, I will believe these equations. Interesting, hey? And I can totally see why my friend felt like Carol was describing religion without, you know, attempting to or saying that that was their purpose. That fascinates me. Here's a very smart person whose whole career is about taking seriously things he can't directly observe and coming up with ways of thinking about those things that help to explain what he is seeing and experiencing in everyday life. For him, for Carol, that's physics. For other people, it's other things. But it's not just about that, as Carol describes it. It's not just about observing the things we can observe and having them help us understand things that we can't directly observe. It's also about finding ways of holding those observations loosely, about saying, this is the equation that works for me now, but if a better equation comes along, I'm going to take that just as seriously. I'm going to engage with that just as deeply. Oh, but we do not like to change equations. We don't like it a bit. It messes with our sense of equilibrium. It screws up our experiences of belonging. It makes family dinners complex and contentious. And it gets us kicked out of or shunned by clubs we used to be a part of. It is hard to change equations. And then just to really pile it on, we're in the middle of a pandemic that might already be making us feel like our change bucket is full to the brim. And Tim Penner, in your transition out of community time, you talked about this, and in particular about the back-to-school aspects of this. Man, so much change. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But one of the human behaviors that has been well documented is that of sort of snapping back to previous systems of belief when we're under duress. I first read some of this research as part of a series of sociological studies about corporate change. The dominant conclusion of those studies was that we're resistant to change. I don't think we needed a series of studies to prove that one. I just had a quick glance at our own lives, but also that when we get into the process of change and it doesn't seem to be going well or it's making big demands, one of the things that we tend to do is to revert to whatever system we were operating under when things seemed like they were going well. In the corporate world, this tends to be the story of companies that don't flourish. In religion, this tends to be the story of things like intransigent fundamentalisms, belief systems that just doesn't matter how much information comes at them to demonstrate that there's something flawed about them, they just find a way to make it fit. Had a conversation with somebody recently who is in the process of stepping away from a community that they've been part of for the better part of 2 decades, a faith community. And they said, and as part of that conversation, which was a really heartrending one, they said, "Oh, I just, you know, I really miss the simplicity of feeling like everything was working the way that it should. Everything had its place and fit together. And all these people around me, it all fit together for them too. It fit together the same way. Man, stepping away from that to consider another equation, that's really difficult. Really difficult. To put that into the form that Sean Carroll was talking about, it's what happens when we as humans say something like, why would I want to consider a different equation when my life felt so good concurrent with a previous equation? And clearly what I need to do is get back to that old way of believing so that I can have my better, my simpler, my more secure feeling way of life back. And sometimes we really feel like we can snap back. I mean, sometimes we feel like we can't. But all we have to do to see this tendency in us as persons is consider how often we're having conversations in the middle of a pandemic about when things get back to normal. Normal wasn't always all that great. But change is brutal, especially in this particular case, you know, unbidden or unsought for and difficult and many times harmful and even tragic, you know, impetus for change. As I was writing about this and I was thinking about reconsidering religious equations in particular, a song came to mind. This is an oldie. This is even before my time, kids. But I can remember hearing it, and I don't know why it's lodged in my brain as I've been reflecting on it over the last few days. I think maybe I sang a version of it at camp or something like that. But I've got a melody in my head as well without looking it up, and I don't know if it's correct, but it's the one that fits the song in my memory. The composer is someone named Jim Reeves, but the tune was also made popular by Johnny Cash. It's called "Give Me That Old Time Religion," and this is a beauty. It's a succinct musical summary of the kind of thinking that might keep us from doing the work of reconsidering our cherished equations. The chorus is, "Give me that old time religion, give me that old time religion, give me that old time religion. It's good enough for me." The verses have that same rhyming pattern, 3 lines the same, and then a little tag. Verse 1 is, "It was good for the Hebrew children, it was good for the Hebrew children, it was good for the Hebrew children, it's good enough for me." And then that chorus, "Give me that old-time religion, it's good enough for me." Verse 2, "It was good for dad and mother, it was good for dad and mother, it was good for dad and mother, and it's good enough for me. Give me that old-time religion. It will do when I am dying. It will do when I am dying. It will do when I am dying. It's good enough for me. Give me that old time religion. Give me that old time religion. Give me that old time religion. It's good enough for me." That's the melody that stuck in my head, except I think if we sang it at camp or wherever I sang it, the last line had something to do with "in my soul. Give me that old time religion in my soul. The center of myself." I don't want to over-examine this song, but I think it's worth taking a little quick poke at that first verse just to illustrate what I'm talking about. I wonder if when Jim Reeves wrote that, he had any inkling of what the Hebrew children of old believed. What their old-time religion was comprised of. I wonder if he meant what they believed early in their story when God was not one but many, something that's easily discerned in the early stories in the Hebrew texts that we call the Old Testament in the Christian tradition. I wonder if he meant what they believed when that same God in those same stories behaved in ways that were insecure and petulant and that vacillated between being loving and being brutally violent. I wonder if he meant the part of their religion that justified genocide, that made it more than just okay to take land from people that had been there for generations, to burn their crops and to kill them, not just the adults, but the women, the children, the livestock, the whole shooting match. Wait a minute. That last part's starting to sound like colonialism. And until pretty recently, the old-time religion that I grew up seemed to be mostly okay with that. So maybe this equation could work after all, at least for the colonizers. Is that too harsh? Is that too harsh? Or is it just asking if maybe there's a better equation than old-time religion through which to consider both what I can't directly observe and what I can touch and what I can feel? This is where I sometimes feel as though the language of equation, Sean Carroll's language, leaves me feeling a bit detached from the orb of my experience. It's where the language of story or guiding story or myth feels closer to the mark. Now, this analogy really might come up short. But for me, as a musician, the difference between these two is a little bit like acknowledging that music is math, that you can approach it mathematically, but it's also a whole lot of other things that are much harder to explain. It's not the math that makes me well up when I hear a song that I connect with, that feels like it gets at something powerful in my heart. It's not the math that does that. It's the story. Sometimes it's the non-specific concreteness of the story that makes room for the concretions of my story. And we could go on. We could have a whole conversation about what makes art art. We're not going to. But it doesn't feel like equation quite does it justice. We need another lens for this. I think there's a very significant overlap between the language of equations and the language of stories when it comes to what we believe and how that impacts us and those around us. I want to suggest one possible way to think about that overlap. It's often not the story itself that's the crux issue. It's how we hold the story. It's not the equation. It's how we regard the equation. To put it another way, it's not what we believe that matters so much as what that belief produces in us. It's not the story we tell as much as it is what we let the story tell us. Because stories tell us different things if we ask them different questions. Let me give you an example. Recently heard a story out of the U.S. that stands in this sort of complicated space that I've been trying to describe. In March, just as the pandemic began to really sweep through the U.S. and sent the population into lockdown, the city of Philadelphia faced a crisis within a crisis, as was the case all over the land. The schools shut down, educators were scrambling to figure out what to do to keep kids learning moving forward. We have lots of teachers in our community, some veterans, some newly minted, all kind of in the midst of this challenge. You know all about it, and you have your own stories and your own memories of that time too, when all of a sudden everything changed in a day. I heard someone recently say that we shouldn't call what happened in those early months e-learning. We should call it emergency online education, because the timelines were just unbelievable. It was like the whole situation just changed overnight. In Philadelphia, the teachers were like many in North America. They were committed to innovating. They were committed to making this work. They were committed to caring well for their students and their education. And so they got right at it. They started to figure out how to put school online. We can do this. We've got the technology. Let's go online. We'll do virtual school. And within a matter of a day or two, they realized that despite their good intentions, they could not do that. And the reason was that 45% of the school-age kids in Philadelphia didn't have an internet connection. And in the U.S., equal access to education is law. And so because this method of offering education couldn't be provided to everyone, couldn't provide equal access, they were stuck. They couldn't proceed. And then the next day, this all just unrolled with incredible rapidity in this story. The next day, the CEO of Comcast is a large American internet service provider, so like maybe Shaw or Bell would be here. It's family owned, and so the CEO has a lot of heft. In any case, the CEO of Comcast stepped up and donated $5 million worth of tablets so every kid that needed one could have one. And then the school boards took a bunch of their now unused school buses and they turned them into mobile Wi-Fi hotspots, and they parked them in the most undeserved. Boy, did I just step right into where I was headed, ahead of myself. Underserved. Wow. They took those and they put them in the most underserved neighborhoods, and they got the project back underway. I feel like I need to take a pause to just process what I did. Let me do that out loud a little bit. That's a great story, right? And it is. You really can tell that as a story about people pulling together to solve a problem, about wealth being redistributed to address inequity and need and so on. A whole bunch of really positive, really hopeful things. And it's a story that tells us those things well. It fits that equation nicely. What that telling of the story does not do is address this question. Why is it that 45% of the school-age kids in Philadelphia didn't have internet access in the first place? Comcast rolled out some very affordable internet access programs on the heels of the crisis. Why didn't those exist before the crisis? Which part of the let's pull together so no one gets left behind story explains that? And just so we keep this line of questioning in context and we don't blow it off because of a line on the map, Canada's national news magazine Maclean's reported this past month that 11% of this country's households don't have an internet connection. And here in Winnipeg's school division, right here in our backyard, an estimated 40% of students are either without a computer or without internet access at home. This is not somebody else's problem. By the way, if you have an unused computer or printer, you can drop them off locally at Computers for Schools right here in Winnipeg, and that organization will refurbish them and put them into the hands of people who need them either for free or at a very low cost. If your computer is beyond hope, they will properly recycle it. So there's a practical way to plug in there if you want. Now, it's easy to tell a story in ways that sort of keep it in line, that help it to sort of behave, that help it to tell the story that fits the equation that we're already in or that we want to be in. We can do that. And in many cases, when we look at the story another way, we can see that the equation that we've been using, the story that we've been telling, might actually be part of the problem. The Freudian slip. The slip that I made when I was telling the story, when I was talking about the buses, I said they parked them in the most undeserving neighborhoods, didn't I? Well, what I have in my notes is underserved neighborhoods. Wow. Apparently even my subconscious has an opinion about why so many kids didn't have that connection there and why so many kids don't have that connection here. Because there's a story, this is a possibility. I'm not announcing this as a conclusion. Here's another lens. Could it be because we tell a story to ourselves that says that everyone that deserves an internet connection has one? And the people who don't, they don't have it because they don't deserve it. We wouldn't tell a story like that way, would we? We'd tell it another way. But it might be the equation we're using. Let's just take this Philadelphia story, for instance. Here's a question. What shifted about the power holders, about the resource holders' beliefs, about who qualified to have a tablet and internet access? What shifted about that belief? And why did it shift? Why did it shift when it shifted? Will it shift back? Did it shift in any changed way. In case I didn't manage to communicate this clearly, this willingness to examine the equations that are running in the background of our systems of belief is essential, at least if we're interested in holding our beliefs in ways that mean that they can evolve when it's necessary for them to do so. If you grew up inside a Christian belief system that suggested or even outright stated that the equation you were being taught was the last word on explaining both what can be seen and what cannot be seen, I would like to point you to a Jesus story that suggests otherwise. In Matthew 15, Jesus is talking to the gatekeepers of the prevailing religious system of the day for his people. So he's talking to his own established religion, the religion that he's a part of. Jesus was a Jew, and these are the leaders of the prevailing Jewish system. And in this conversation in Matthew, he's responding to the critique that his disciples, that Jesus' disciples, are not doing a good job staying within the religious equation, that they're not keeping the religious rules very well. And at one point in that conversation, he tells the critics that in their zeal for rule keeping, they have, quote, nullified the word of God for the sake of their tradition. I'm sure that was just what they were hoping to hear. They had nullified the word of God for the sake of their tradition. Okay, how about that? It really is, I think, another way of saying if you don't let the story keep evolving, you could end up getting to keep your system, but you could lose the very thing you believe it gives you access to. You could lose your connection to the divine. You could nullify the voice of the divine for the sake of your tradition. Now, Jesus saying things like that arguably got him killed by the same people who were the recognized representatives of this equation that said God is for bringing peace and for bringing settled lives to the people who kept the equation. The people that they called God's people. Management guru Peter Drucker is credited with saying that one of the worst things that can happen to a business is for it to be prematurely right. That's a fascinating way to say that. And sometimes when I read the Jesus stories, that's how they feel to me. Like Jesus was prematurely right about many things, including the ways in which being locked into one religious story in such a way that we refuse to reconsider it can crush our connection to God. It might be too narrow a point of view, but I can't help but wonder if we could say, good idea, bad timing. Prematurely right? Well, if we take that lens on this, then it might raise the question, is this a better time for those ideas? And it seems to me when I consider that question that the answer to it might just be up to us. Over to you. Peace, everybody. It's been good to be with you. This way or any way we can. I want to second Tim's invitation to giving us any ideas you might have about what sort of spaces could facilitate being together. My hope, personally, I don't know if we'll be able to pull this off, and we haven't made any collective commitment to it, but I would love to be able to get together outdoors at least one more time before we would have to bundle up in snowmobile suits to do it. But as the year winds into fall and winter, it would still be lovely to find some ways, at least on occasions, to be together, depending how this thing unfolds. So if you have ideas about space that might facilitate that under the current guidelines, please let us know. You know how to find me, and I'll happily forward that to the rest of the leadership group and to the community. So, peace to you. I look forward to that day when we can be together, and I enjoy this day and this way of being together as well, and I'm grateful for it. All right. Peace, everybody. Bye for now.